Now, select literary criticism on Sons and Lovers. First, it is generally agreed that Sons and Lovers is one of Lawrence's best novels. I take it to be one of his best three and perhaps one of the best novels written in the English language in the first half of our century by Alessio Vivas. Second, what Lawrence was trying to do in Sons and Lovers, besides writing a book that would give him the rewards of authorship and others' purely external ends, was to achieve a grasp of his experience in its context. This called for his producing a coherent picture of his life and of the life of his family in terms of those factors that he took to have been important in their development. Central to the picture, there had to be an account of two conflicts. The first, that between his father on the one hand and his mother and the children on the other. The second, their triangular conflict between his mother, his sweetheart, and himself. There also had to be an account of the discovery of his talent and its growth. The selected episode set finally to be fitted into a harmonious whole by Alessio Vivas. Thirdly, the characters of Sons and Lovers are less complete in their detail. There is a blur in many of them so that we are not sure of the focus, but they are life-size. They are as big as Lawrence is. Lawrence is a murdering narrator. Totally unskilled in construction, all right, he seems to stay, let the living people drag on as they can. They will move and compel because they'll live, because he will make us share their life in the collier's cottage, in the factory where Paul Morrell works, on the farm where he spends his holiday. Instantaneously, we shall breathe with them, and it is the power to make the reader's chest rise and fall, as it were, with breathing of the characters in all the off moments, the lost hours, the indecipherable days of their life, that gives Sons and Lovers an overwhelming intimacy. There is no novel in English literature which comes so closely to the skin of life of working class people, for it records their feelings in their own terms. By V.S. Pritchett. Fourthly, Sons and Lovers is autobiography in much more serious sense. It has been held by authorities on the subject as the first genuine example of psychoanalytical fiction in English. There had been plenty of novels of psychological analysis ever since George and Eliot Meredith had set writers plunging off further and further into the deeps and revealing the play of unconscious impulses. The line of development led directly to the work of James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, and Dorothy Richardson, who have been intent on what they call the stream of consciousness by E.A. Baker. Fifth, Sons and Lovers, which followed in 1913, is largely autobiographical. The plot is formally knit, the characters well drawn and seen from the outside in the round, as well as realized emotionally from within. This novel contains some of Lawrence's finest descriptions of life in the mining village in which he was born, and a striking feature is the freshness and delight in nature which everywhere informs the book. The subtlety of Lawrence's insight into the psychology of the emotionally possessive mother is nowhere better shown than in his study of conflict between Miriam and Mrs. Morrell for the soul of the younger son Paul by S. Diana Nell. Sixthly, and yet, when all these factors are taken into account, as they must be, the critic, the fact remains that Lawrence was a greater writer and that Sons and Lovers, the first of his three great novels, is a superbly written book. He was a great artist, but he was also a great writer, which is to say, a master of language by Alessio Vivas. Seventh, Sons and Lovers goes wrong when Lawrence begins telling lies. That is to say, when he starts arguing, as in the Miriam episode, which is often boring and obscure. English novelists are afraid and ashamed of adult sin because later in life, to be serious about oneself is considered priggish and conceited. I have always liked Clara Davis' episode in Sons and Lovers, partly because it begins well, and partly for the grotesque scene where Clara's mother sits up, belligerently determined to prevent the lovers from going to bed together. There is a guilty hangdog humor and great truth of observation in the episode, although the character of Clara Davis is over-glorified by her sexual attraction to the author. By V.S. Pritchett. 8. The literal accuracy of the autobiographic record is open to question. The woman who was the original of Miriam later published a book which gave a different impression of her relation with Lawrence. But in all essentials, she had interpreted his own experience in terms of the Oedipus complex, though as it yet he knew about Freud only at second hand. The hatred of the sons for their father and his frustrated sense of inferiority, which drives him to violence and drink, helped to make Sons and Lovers the first significant novel of 20th century psychological analysis, though in the formal structure and realistic detail, it is still in the 19th century tradition. Lawrence was not concerned with his characters in the context of society or with their moral or political ideas. He concentrated upon their most intimate emotional relationship and their sensuous and physical surroundings. By Lionel Stevenson. 9. Personal relationships then constitute the main subjects which Lawrence proposes to himself in Sons and Lovers, and it is the development of personal relationship which dictates the structures of the novel. Of plot, in the contrived and mechanical sense, there is very little, though the storyline is firm and clear. The progress of the novel is chronological, recording the years as they pass, and the crucial stages are marked by the endings of the old relationships and the beginnings of new ones. This simple scheme is perfectly adequate. The subtleties of Sons and Lovers are not a sophisticated organization or a concern with art for art's sake. The unity of the novel is organic in that it regards developing lives and people in contact with each other, moving from a beginning to an end. By Christopher Hanson. 10. Mrs. Morrell's religion is presented here not as a chapel going, but as a moral obligation to face reality, to be responsible for one's life, to have integrity. She does not merely make impossible demands of moral. She goes more than halfway to meet him. She accepts the squalor and poverty. She is a model housewife and mother. She sees in Mr. Levers a man who would have let her help him. Even little Barker is 10 times the man Morrell is. Through irresponsibility, he forfeits his health. He loses the energy even to quarrel with bully, and when Mrs. Morrell dies, is left a pathetic, lifeless figure. Even if we feel that her demands were impossible, that Morrell could not become responsible, he is not to be forgiven in Lawrence's strictly existential morality. For the real tragedy went on in Morrell in spite of himself. He is even responsible for his accidents in the pit. By Keith Sager. The second third of the novel is concerned largely with Miriam. Though Mrs. Morrell's presence is always felt gradually, Paul comes to mediate between Miriam and life. Miriam lives through her soul. She finds difficulty in assimilating sensuous experience, and she was cut off from ordinary life by her religious intensity, which made the world for her either a new mirror garden or a paradise where sin and knowledge were not, or else an ugly, cruel thing. Miriam's intensity, her inability to be ordinary, is taken up again and again. Eh, my Hubbard, she sang in a voice heavy and surcharged with love. Eh, my Hubbard. And folding him in her arms, she swayed slightly from side to side with love, her face half lifted, her eyes half closed, her voice drenched with love. Don't, said the child uneasy, don't, Miriam. This trance, like ecstasy, her face half lifted, her eyes half closed, is typical for Miriam. Paul is an uneasy as a child, contrasting her behavior with his mother's normality. By Keith Sager.